Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking climate change on the program today. We're talking with four Cache Valley residents who recently were at the biggest march on the subject in history. Almost 400,000 people marched in downtown New York City on Sunday. And we have with us Jim Goodwin, Jack Green, Rebecca McFall, and Rob Davies. You guys said you started at the end, so it was about 3 hours before you got to the starting line. So before we get back to the topic in general, I want to get some more impressions from the march. This is, you know, big. What you're hoping is a seminal event, right?
Absolutely.
So what are some other things that stood out to you from the march?
I would like to speak of the power of music, which is something, of course, that's very present in my life on a daily basis. But this march was full of so much creativity and good energy. There were, I don't know, 40 some marching bands. We had the great pleasure of marching beside a Haitian band from Brooklyn, and this was late into the march, and I think we were on the streets for about 7 hours and a bit foot weary, and these fabulous musicians playing on homemade instruments had everybody springing into spontaneous dance, and I would say that it works as a wonderful metaphor for what we can do when we come together creatively, and that's exactly what we need to employ as we face these challenges. We need to be looking ahead towards not just all that's scary, but what these transformational changes could bring to our society to make it healthier and a better place to live for everybody.
So, a positive message.
I certainly came away from this march with just incredibly life affirming for me, and it was at a time when I needed it. I think, as you were mentioning, you can fall into despair when you're really paying attention to these headlines, and it's another way of looking away. Denying the science is a way of looking away. Saying it's not happening to me is a way of looking away, and giving up is a way of looking away. And so for me, this and I think for everybody there, this was an incredible shot in the arm of hope.
I should say parenthetically that there are people who sincerely believe there is not a problem. You know, and so they're not in any of those categories that you're talking about, but certainly there are some people in the middle that would fall into categories you were talking about, Rebecca. So, Jack, the people lining the streets, or was everybody in the parade, in the march, or what was the atmosphere?
It was both. I think there were people lining the streets, and then there were people in the thick of the march. Mm-hmm. And there were, event that I found particularly moving. We were marching down Central Park. There was a group of Buddhists in meditation, and in beautiful, serene meditation, all lined up facing the march in this solidarity. It was tremendously moving.
Mm-hmm. And also in Times Square, there were a group of people obviously in town for something else. And I think they're kind of slack-jawed as these hundreds of thousands of people went by. And what in the world is this?
They didn't get the memo, I guess. Okay. Yeah, Jack.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on the interfaith presence there. I'm guessing that there were well over 100 different faiths represented. And I talked to some of them. I saw their signs and so on. So I think, again, faith is huge. I personally don't claim a particular religion, but I know the vast majority of humanity does, and to see that influence, I think, is huge, because they're going to take that back to their congregations, to their members, and so on. And as Jim mentioned earlier, I think those who attended it, as much as we can spread it, since the media isn't doing what we had hoped it would on this, we can personally, through social media and other ways, we can all make a difference in broadcasting the feelings that we had, which were intense. It was euphoric, hours of euphoria. So,
I wanted to mention, too, that we also had one of our good friends, Rue Mahoney, executive director of the Stokes Nature Center, was right there arm in arm with us. So she's in the air today. She dearly wanted to be on the show, but she wasn't. One thing that I've never heard before in any march or large gathering is when we're in a football stadium, we all know what the wave is. People stand up and, you know, and it goes around the stadium. Well, the same thing happened along the canyons of New York City, where way off in the distance, you would hear this yelling, screaming, and it kind of sounded like a jet coming. And then it would just roll along the street and go right over the top of you and keep going. It was an astounding noise. It was great.
It was. There was one particular moment which had been organized by the people who put the march together, that at 2 minutes to 1 o'clock there was going to be 2 minutes of silence to honor the victims of climate change, and it was incredibly powerful. Everybody's arms were in the air, and you could suddenly hear the wind going through the trees of Central Park, and this is a lot of people to be silent. And then at 1 o'clock it was time to sound the alarm for climate change, and there was this roar, just as Jim described, a tsunami of sound rolling down the streets, kind of towards you, through you, past you, and it will be with me forever.
You know,
extraordinary.
You know, Tom, earlier you asked why we went too, and certainly it takes some effort, quite a bit of effort for most of us to get there. We've got a lot going on. There's time, there's expense, there's an environmental impact to doing this travel, and that's something none of us do lightly. And hundreds of thousands of people made that effort. And I think what many people recognized is that we wanted this one event to be as big as possible, to make as big a statement as possible. And it's, you know, when you work in your communities, you can often feel isolated. And I don't think we feel that here in Logan. There's a very strong, active community trying to move this issue forward. But I think many people, we can all have our low moments, and the solidarity of joining together in this massive statement of just bodies in the streets, peacefully, as Rebecca said, joyfully even, was incredibly powerful for, I think, the people who participated, as well as a show of force to the people who maybe haven't been paying attention yet. But it was just powerfully energizing. So it tells you, you know, you're not working in a vacuum. There is this acknowledgement from hundreds of thousands of your fellow humans. And if 400,000 people showed up, imagine how many people really think this is an issue.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And 400,000 is just this one march. Marches worldwide, including Salt Lake. Yeah. By the way, the number is 1-800-826-1495. Love to get your experience. Maybe you marched in New York. Maybe you marched in Salt Lake City. What's your feeling on this? And what are you doing in your personal life? If you believe that this is a serious problem, what are you doing? Ideas. And what would you propose? What would you, if you were able to stand up in front of the UN Assembly today, what would you say? I'll ask this question to my guests here. 1-800-826-1495. Would love to get your opinion as well. 1-800-826-1495 or upraxcess@gmail.com. And we're on Twitter at Utah Public Radio. So I want to talk solutions. And I'll get into this, as I made reference to before the break. Mark Bittman in the New York Times. Thanks, Steve, for sending this to me. He says, capitalism needs to expand in order to survive. Then he goes on to talk about ExxonMobil, et cetera, et cetera. And he says, losses that fossil fuel companies face if we're to reduce the impact of climate change somewhere between 10 and 20 trillion, according to estimates of, he references Chris Hayes in an article, with costs, so that's comparable to costs to slaveholders at the end of the Civil War. Interesting comparison. This was within the government's power, can be, but not this day. So he goes on to say, that's why so many centrist liberals and progressives are depressed into inaction. They see no way of winning this struggle, no matter how critical. And, of course, Mr. Bittman is saying, let's reject the inevitable. And he goes on to talk about renewables. What, maybe starting with Jim Goodwin, what would you propose as solutions? What would you urge at the UN, U.S. government, etc.?
Well, in answering this, I think that this couldn't be a better time to be a young person wondering what you're going to do with your life. I mean, the technology's there, everything's there to make a change. And if I were at the UN, I would encourage these educators. We have three educators here with us today. Keep pushing on letting young people show them the way. I mean, my God, if we can drill 9,000 feet into the roiling North Atlantic to get oil, we can do pretty much anything to get our energy. So let's encourage the young people. Huh. Fantastic way to go.
Jack.
Yes. Working almost daily with youth here on campus and other places, I will be attending Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education conference in Portland, Oregon here in October. And we will have several thousand show up all the way from administration to in higher education to a lot of students and others. So the job market that is there now and going strongly in that direction, whether it be with food production, which, by the way, food has a huge, that's one of the major things we do is our food choices have a huge impact on all of this, to the renewable energy, to energy efficiency, on and on and on. But anyway, and if we were to transition from fossils, which, by the way, slavery, we are enslaved to fossil fuels, not a good situation as we were enslaved to blacks here in our country not too long ago, a few generations ago. We've got to break those shackles, if you will, and escape from fossil fuels to renewables. And I see a number of studies that show that if we were to transition to renewables, it would provide a lot more jobs than it would if sticking with the fossil fuels, not to mention all of the extraneous costs that go with despoiling a lovely biosphere.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca.
I would love to quote, actually, a headline from The Onion, which this was from a couple of years ago, but it's funny because it's true.
Impeccable source.
Yes. The headline read, scientists politely remind lawmakers that renewables are ready to go whenever. And it's true. It's true. We need to move away from, I think, this notion that the conversation is still between people who don't believe this is happening and a 97% scientific consensus that it is. Mm. And we need to have a more sophisticated conversation than that, because if we don't, the only thing that's changing is the climate.
I'll pose the same question to Rob, but with this preamble. So is it true renewables are ready to go whenever? I hear this. A lot of renewables can't be scaled up to the, at least right now, to the point where we need them.
Well, you heard wrong, Tom.
Okay.
there is no question that the knowledge and the technology that we need to meaningfully address this issue we already possess, and it is a question of the inertia that we have moving forward. What is to be done? Is we have many people have been working on this for many decades, and what really is to be done is for us to put our efforts and energies in doing that, you know, that's what events like this march have been about, is to get we pay attention to what troubles us and we pay attention to what energizes us, and issue of climate change should do both. I should mention also that, you know, we often talk about it. The conversation often gets framed in terms of environmental in economic costs, and what does it cost to fix climate change? And a lot of calculation has been done on that. What happens is you need to recognize what it costs not to fix climate change. Right now, I think the comparison that Bittman made to slavery is an apt one. Look at the societal cost of that institution to us. Nothing good came out of that, and we've been dealing with the societal costs ever since. The Southern slave owners might have said, what is it going to cost us to get rid of this institution? Look at what it cost us not to get rid of it for so long. And that is what's going to happen here with this. And that can be quantified. The science is very clear on that. And the science tells us what we need to do to move away from this. I mean, there are many policy paths you can take, but the bottom line is we got to get off fossil fuels, and we got to do it soon. And that's just physics. And so from there on, as Rebecca said, we've got to stop talking about this. We've got to move away from this discussion of, well, X percent of the people don't agree with you. We've got to actually energize those people with what they're facing if we don't, and the rewards that we face and can collect if we do.
Is that the tenor of the – I wanted to plug your TEDx USU. You're going to give a talk along with your colleague Rob Gillies.
So the tenor of that talk next month is going to be about having the conversation. And actually the inspiration for this talk is Rebecca, who frequently says the silence on this issue here in Utah to her is deafening. You know, you can imagine any big societal issue. We talk about it in the coffee shops and around the dinner tables and out in the streets and at work. And right there's another poll that shows now, Tom, that the climate change is now the single most divisive issue in this nation. So think about that. We will sit around the Thanksgiving table with our relatives that challenge us, and we will talk about gun rights, we will talk about immigration, we will talk about marriage equality, and we will even talk about abortion just to avoid talking about climate change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that has to stop. Mm-hmm. And we need, this silence has to stop. The scientists, we've kind of done as much as we can do. We've told you in every way we know how. And now it's time for, you know, friends don't let friends believe nonsense. And we need to have those conversations.
Before we get to you, Jim, this is an email from Joe in Cache Valley. He says, what was the carbon footprint of the march? I'm in support of sustainable activities. Would you consider this a sustainable event? Seems like flying in an airplane over a weekend event is not sustainable. Rob made reference to this earlier. I don't know if somebody wanted to respond to this.
I think about it every time, and yes, I purchased carbon offsets for the flight. I'm hoping that it will move the needle in such a direction that it will offset its carbon footprint. Certainly, it had a carbon footprint. Our entire way of living has a carbon footprint, and we need to change the systems that support the way that we live. And right now, we are all complicit inside these systems and still had to use some of them in order to have this experience. So certainly in the thinking, and that's how I'm looking at it.
All right. I think the calculus you do is you think of it as an investment. You know, we're trapped, as Rebecca aptly said, we're trapped in a system, so we're going to use this system to change it. And right now we have no other choice. So the carbon footprint that the march had, you think of as an investment up front now to lowering it much more later on.
If I could have flown on an airplane using biofuels, I would have done that.
All right. Maybe that's in the future. We just have about 1 minute left. Jim, you wanted to say something.
Oh, I was just going to say with 50 or 60 million net gain of people on Earth every year, whether we like it or not, we're going to have to work together to figure out joint solutions. I mean, again, here in the Intermountain West, don't tell me what to do is prevalent, but that just doesn't cut it anymore. We have to work together or the wave's going to roll over us, and we have to be grown up enough to say that the UN and their Agenda 21 isn't going to be the black helicopters rolling into Cache Valley to take over. That's just nonsense.
We'll leave it there. Since Steve sent this in, I want to make reference to it. This is a opinion piece from Paul Krugman, New York Times. He cites two reports which say that strong measures to limit carbon emissions would have hardly any negative effect on economic growth, might actually lead to faster growth. We talked a little bit about that earlier in the program. So Jim Goodwin, Jack Green, Rebecca McFall, Rob Davies, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
And join me tomorrow. We will talk with the author of a beautiful new novel. It's All the Light We Cannot See, set in World War II. That's Anthony Durr, and that's tomorrow on the program. Thanks for listening today.